Well, welcome to Homepage Radio, a monthly program with me, Duo Dickinson. I'm an architect and a writer, but more importantly, it's at WPKN, one of the great radio stations in America, but also a radio station that only exists because of people like you and you and you and maybe me and a few people in this studio that actually spend time and money to make this place happen. So this is a fundraising time, and I just wanted to open by saying if you call the fundraising number when it's operative, and it's not operative right this moment, but when it's operative, I would really love it if you gave them $50, and then I will give to you a signed copy of my former book called Staying Put, which is a great compendium of work, but it's a real testament to how much you love PKN, and so do call. But today's show has nothing to do with staying put, but it has everything to do with homes, just like everything else that's on Homepage Radio here on WPKN, because everybody lives somewhere, everybody lives in a place, and everybody has objects in that place. So today we really want to talk about what are your objects? What are objects in our lives and in our spaces, and because it's Homepage, what are lives in our homes? You know, many people consider their home to be the biggest object they own, but even in the tiniest of those objects we call home are things that we truly love, no matter how small or rented or shared or even squatted in. All these spaces have things that are natural extensions of us. They're inanimate pets of our subconscious. They're things that we have an inordinate amount of history and an inordinate amount of love for. They're not necessarily, you know, our clothes or our appliances or something to sleep in, but there are stuff. There are things that mean a great deal to us, and our stuff has to exist somewhere. It's usually near us. It's stuff we often use, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's just something that evokes some memory or some emotion that we have, and because of that, we feel about it in a way that is illogical. It's wonderful. It's something that really makes us human. So today I'd like to really talk about, with a great group of people, two here in the studio and two others, or actually one other, but before I go any further, I want to welcome Rod Richardson, my engineering guru. Rod, how are you?
I'm fine, although making a few errors in this particular edition, but we'll fix it.
Well, I will tell you, I never make an error, ever, which makes living very boring.
Well, I make more mistakes than I'd like, but it is what it is.
Well, my middle name is Mistake, so
that's good.
Thank
to know.
You, Tom. Yeah. Anyway.
All right.
Our basic reality here today is going to be, why do we love our things? And I think it has to do with history, and I think it has to do with being cool, but I also think there is a dark side. There's an aspect to American culture especially, which is the Walmarts, the Amazons that have now eaten Whole Foods, the home shopping network where automatons dressed in pluswear end up pushing stuff into our lives that we don't need or want, and make us feel guilty unless we buy it. So objects aren't just wonderful, soft, and fuzzy little creatures that we've brought into our lives to worship. They're also maybe part of something about ourselves we don't like. Maybe we care too much about our dark sides, maybe too much about our objects that evince those things. And even in everything around us, everything I'm sitting in this studio, everything that it gets built, as an architect, I build a lot of things, and every single thing that I do that involves designing combines objects to make a whole, so that you could make a case that objects aren't just those beloved things. They're also every piece and parcel that we all see. And we'll be talking to two people here today that I'm going to introduce now, which really, I think, to me, convey the essence of two different ways of looking at objects. The first is Joe DeRisi. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
So Joe, if you don't know, is the creator of Urban Miners. Joe, just give us a quick date on that. When did you start Urban Miners?
Short answer, 10 years.
So 10 years since the Depression exploded and killed all of us, Joe DeRisi has really walked the talk of sustainability out of Hamden, his home and office, and is opening up a new facility here in Bridgeport very soon. And he started all this with a master's degree in resource management as well as a certificate in deconstruction, and I think that might be facetious, and has really worked locally as an environmental analyst and a conservationist, and he was a building contractor before those. And in truth, he saved things, but now he is actually recycling things and has won the 2012 Green Business Advocate Award, or Business Advocate Award, Green Business Advocate Award, and has also been designated as Business New Haven's Rising Star of 2010 and 2010. And I think Carrie Triffin, Fairhaven Woodworks, that then became Fairhaven Furniture, started, what, 30 or 40 years ago?
1981.
So 36 years ago.
Yeah.
When did the name change, by the way, happen to Fairhaven Furniture?
Oh, I'm not good at that. I don't know. 15 years ago.
Years ago. And it really was a wonderful segue, because I'm an old woodworker guy, and I got to know Carrie that way. And in truth, he went from a place that had incredible beauty of found and made objects to then almost a, I would say Fairhaven Furniture is almost a temple of the love of objects and the beauty of objects. And it's in New Haven, in the Fairhaven District of New Haven. And basically, he started out life just in love with wood. He actually worked for the Walgreen Tree Experts in New Haven. And he also went to the local community college, Yale, and he degreed in the thing that I'm speaking now, which passes for English, but also in business administration. And he is very, very, very obsessed, really obsessed with objects in a good way. And before we go to our next guest, which will hopefully join us by phone, which is Turner Brooks, an incredibly great architect, but also an educator. I just ask you guys to give me, either one first, the sort of almost Cliff Notes reality of why do you love objects?
I can give you one loud and clear. When you asked the question prior to this interview, think about things that you in your house that you love. I went around and I thought, and I, you know, there was this. I'm sure it's an exaggeration, but there really was just one thing that I loved, or it's probably just the thing I loved the most. And it's a little gourd that this famous gourd lady down in the Carolinas, Sparky Sparkman, would take gourds, thousands of them, and decorate them. This one's looks like a little pig with a curly tail and pointy ears and prettily painted. And I gave it to my mom. My mom named it Marguerite after a woman that she knew when she was young. And she took it and would lend it to different people and say, Marguerite will help you because you're feeling down these days, and or you're sick, or you're whatever. And
The animated object.
Yeah, and she would pass it on, and it's now on my desk at home with these very solicitous eyes. And there's a thing that costs nothing practically and is full of humanity.
And love.
And love, all the way.
Joe, do you have a gourd?
If I did, I'd have a container full of them. that's the problem.
Or the opportunity.
Yeah, there's so many ways I could look at objects. So I would try to sum it up as they are for me the evidence of everything that's behind them. Right.
Oh, yeah.
So if it's something manufactured in the mid-50s in the United States, there's whatever was behind that. If it's, an archaeological piece, I sort of like the full range of capturing things from that kind of digging in the dirt to taking things apart on a big scale.
And right? What do you think would be the one object that has spoken most lovingly to you in the last lifetime?
Well, can we look at a house as one object?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, because it's as we'll probably discuss, it's a million objects in one form, right? So, not that I dislike commercial buildings, but I think old houses, and the older the better, are sort of something that really captures it for me.
And that would be your house, perhaps?
No, my house was, my current house was built in 1960 with newer additions.
Getting older every day.
Yeah, yeah. But it has a lot more character than the house we lived in previously, which was only a year old when we bought it.
Yeah.
So we're making progress by buying older houses. I don't know.
So that's a little taste of what's going to happen after I get to the deep background of objects, because objects do not exist. They are simply not present unless they are surrounded by something. And Turner Brooks is an incredible architect who I've known my whole adult life and has made a time teaching and creating universal space. So while we go to a break, we'll try to get a hold of Turner Brooks in New Haven, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Homepage Radio. Just to let you know, get your pens out. If you want to be part of this conversation after I talk to Turner, give a call at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. We'd love to have your take on your objects and your sense of what objectivity is. Turner.
Hello.
This is Turner Brooks, who teaches architecture at Yale and practices architecture in a wonderful set of artist lofts, Erector Square in New Haven. And his work has also been celebrated by the Princeton Architectural Press, and he's also had a record house, which is a big deal. But you might best know him as the architect of the Gilder Boathouse on Route 34, going up there to Derby, and also as an amazingly beautiful building at Cold Spring School, right in the heart of New Haven. And Turner is not just a talented human. He's actually had other talented humans tell him he's talented by giving him a mid-career Rome Prize, which is about as high as you can get in the international world of recognition of designy types, and something called the Sydney Mishkiminen Klaus 75 Prize for Teaching in Humanities. Turner, you got a prize for teaching.
Unbelievable.
I think
don't inflate my reputation any further.
Well, you know what I always say? Low bars are the easiest to be excellent with. So I have a very important question for you, and I really think only you can answer it with my friends. And you've created a lot of space, you teach a lot of space. Could you give us your description of space and its power?
I'll try. I always feel that the issue of space itself is a little bit under-recognized in the talk about architecture. It seems to be more about form and space, surface, and those issues, which are also important. But I think the fundamentally important issue of architecture is the space that it makes, and that space, of course, is always related to the human body and its movements around the space. I like to think of good spaces, and I give this as a project to my students at school, as something that's not just emptiness, but is palpable, and the air feels full of kind of energy. A good example of this would be Grand Central Station.
Yes.
It's a huge space, to be sure. But it becomes, I think, palpably full and very cozy, actually, even though it's enormous, partly because of the reflection of all of the patter of footsteps that are being echoed or relayed back off of the vault, the main vault of the ceiling, which fills the atmosphere. And ever since being a child, I've felt very cozy walking in that space, either to leave the city or to arrive the city, and I still have those feelings. So I think space has to be talked about as something that is more than just emptiness. And good spaces are full, and I've had this fantasy all my life in the Baroque churches of a great Roman architect named Francesco Borromini to release maybe 500 bats. I would have to get a special grant to do this, 500 bats into the space, because nobody choreographs space as well as the bat fluttering around in a sort of amazing space aficionado ballet-like creature. Anyway, I don't know how long I should go on.
But I think you've gone on.
This issue that space is full and is a palpable entity rather than nothingness is important to me.
Well, you're the one person that I think could answer this question. So my take on Grand Central Station is actually the same, is that it's huge and intimate and powerful.
Yeah.
But do you think that the objects, as I define them in that space, which are the humans... Do you think
that the objects inside the space are the humans. Human beings? I think that's what brings the space alive and makes
that's
it meaningful. It's no single object, although the clock is pretty good on the observation booth or whatever, the central booth there is pretty amazing. But I think it's really, it really is the thing that makes it a space is the wandering around in it.
And you really do focus on movement and sound more than anybody that I know. And you created a place for the human brain at Yale. Could you describe that project just a little bit to us and how those consistent but incredibly different objects helped you make the space?
Yeah, it was a funny project because it was in the basement of the library, in a tiny space, the library of the medical school. And it was to house something like 800 bottles of beautiful brains extracted by the goodly Dr. Cushing, who's the kind of the pioneer of modern brain surgery, lived in the last century. The interesting thing is the brains were lost after all these kind of other electronic imaging technologies came into place, and then they were rediscovered in a deep sub-basement of a medical school building, and the current professor of neurosurgery, Dennis Spencer, thought they should be displayed, and that's what they were. So it's a little bit designed as a kind of folding series of cabinets that might sort of represent the folds of the brain. This kind of very dense atmosphere where you don't necessarily see everything at once, but you open drawers and cabinets, and so you have to sort of participate actively with your body to find the sort of goal of your search. I would say the space is kind of circuitous and meandering, and that partly makes the space seem bigger because it's actually physically a very small space. But I also think it sort of reflects the sort of the journey and the thinking about where you're going and remembering where you were and where you're about to be and so forth.
My take on a lot of the stuff that everybody sees in the venerated modern architecture pieces around is that essentially it is all about surface and space and not about time, movement, or objects. And my sense is that light and space and movement and memory are the things that electrify the spaces you're talking about. And a lot of that has to happen when there are or is an object or are objects that actually can hit that. And I was going to ask you, because I don't know the answer.
Can I say one?
Oh, absolutely.
I don't want to undermine the value of objects at all.
And yeah.
I just remember this, that in one of my earliest houses that I actually lived in with my family for a long time, there was a cabinet that I call the ancestral reliquary, which was directly on the central axis of the house,
yes.
And even related to the axis of a distant mountain seen through the windows. But the axis of goes through the house, through the living room, up through a window in the bedroom, across the center of the headboard, and then ends in this cabinet in the wall, high up on the wall, which I've called the ancestral reliquary, which has sort of silly mock relics. There's a shoe of my grandfather, for example. There are three books of his favorite poems. There's some dolls of my grandmother's, and a few other crazy old toys of my own that I love and would never be able to throw away. And the back of the ancestral reliquary opens to a secret passageway.
What?
A tiny passageway that goes to the children's bedrooms, so the children could actually merge with the ancestral relics when they when they wanted to. And it resulted in an amazing play where a sarcophagus was opened, and the kids were about 6 and 8.
Wow.
Opened in the living room below, and then the spirit of the departed, whoever it was, floats up through the living room, manipulated by a thread of my youngest son, who was in the ancestral reliquary, and the spirit disappears in the ancestral reliquary. So it became a sort of active part. My point is, the object became a kind of active part of the theater of life in the house or whatever.
I think that story, let me bring Carrie Triffin in for a second. Carrie, do you find that people share that magic sense of activating the objects that are at Fairhaven Furniture? Do you find that that's part of why people buy this stuff?
I think so, and I think people feel, well, there was a gentleman came in a few years ago with his 6 or 7 year old daughter, and as they were touring the place and I was kind of tagging along, at one point the daughter turned to the dad and said, "Is this a rubby-dubby place?" And he said, "Oh, yes." And I said, "What in the world is a rubby-dubby place?" He said, "Well, in our family, when something has been made by hand by somebody who cared about what they were doing, we call that a rubby-dubby object."
Wow.
And I just, yes, I think in that way, people come in and they interact with stuff that, I mean, we all have too much stuff, or most of us have too much stuff, but less can be more, and I think focusing on the human aspect where it touches you in some fashion. You touch it, it touches you.
So
I think the thing of the space of the room, it's a great segue. Then the space of the furniture you're sitting in, it's all related. The furniture is sort of the ultimate nesting, cozy space in the larger space of the room, and I think it all relates if it's done right.
And I think if I may, it's something that is accessible to each and every one of us. I mean, human needs have remained largely unchanged through the millennia. Yeah. If you could pick a spot, you could pick a spot in the house and say, okay, that's kind of, not that it's only for me, but that's a place where I'm going to put a fabric that feels right to me, a color that warms me, that makes me happy, a light that is the right amount of light. And maybe other people in the house will know, if you're sitting there, maybe I should ask before I interrupt. And it becomes a place that you can enlarge in.
So Joe, you end up finding those objects that had all the rubby-dubby and all of the focus that Carrie was talking about. You find them now abandoned. What object do you recall really has that, the sense that Turner was talking about, that sense of extreme history, veneration, but also activism that's in its history? Do you remember one object in particular in your time?
Let's see. What's one out of infinity? That's hard to.
Yeah. Is there one that you remember?
Well, just the first thing that popped into my mind, because we have a relationship with Yale here, is the coal stove from one of the headmaster houses that was demolished. One, because it was so big and ominous, and I never seen one that big, and it was black with like gold detail, and it had a function. And then another curious part about it is a part of the building had to come down first before we could get it out. And I wasn't actually involved in that process. That was the demo contractor. But it just sort of, it has an unknown history to me. Like, when did they stop using it to actually heat the house? You know, and that kind of thing.
Cook food or whatever it
was. Yeah, and it was just this big, amazing thing.
An amazing almost focus on probably 50 or 100 years of history and use and time and decoration and presence.
Yeah, and then this sort of ties into, you know, my dilemma with objects. And now it's it's in a basement in a house that needs to be gone.
Oh, no.
So it's sort of like, here's something else with objects. Like, a lot of times I'll go in and the goal is to deconstruct a house.
Yeah.
And inevitably, there seems to be one or more pianos because no one wants to take them when they leave.
Right.
So I get into this interesting predicament because there's not a good market for pianos. Do I save the house and disassemble every piece to save that and then throw the piano in the dumpster? Mm. No, now I have to save the piano,
yes.
But there's no market for them. So one of the solutions is you disassemble it and sell it as parts.
Yep, there you go. You know, so Turner, you're getting a flavor of what we're talking about today, and I don't want to take any more of your time. I'd love it if you could leave us with where you are now. I would assume that you're incredible cabinet is still with you and never will leave you. But
it's still there, full of dust,
which is the memory of all of us. But you have a family and you've got young women living with you. What do you think now, if you had to sort of pull back from, I think, your incredible journey understanding and designing and fostering the design of spaces, what object for you right now seems to maintain your focus in your family, but elsewhere too?
Well, I guess what I will reveal is I, from my grandfather, I inherited a old toy steam engine, and it sits on top of the wood stove, and the wood stove is certainly one of these sort of, you know, wonderful draws of not only just the visual thing that looks great, but it's also warm, emanating warmth into the room. So that becomes an important object in itself. But then the steam engine on top of the wood stove is a very both dynamic and cozy thing, because you put a little fire, probably Sterno is the easiest, underneath it, and it slowly starts hissing, and then the piston starts churning, and then a little bit of smoke comes out the chimney, and the whole thing is, running on steam power. It's just, to me, that's always been a very cheerful mode of power. So the steam engine is sort of, it's about a foot and a half tall and about 8 inches. The boiler's about 8 inches in diameter. That's the sort of central thing, I suppose.
Did you play with that in your youth?
Yeah.
I think it's incredible, Turner, that basically what you're describing is, of course, objects in space, but it really isn't. It's really about memory and time and movement and kinesthesiology. It's basically the idea of your presence in space, but really connecting to the things that are bathed in the space. I can't thank you enough, Turner.
Well, thank you. It's a big, important issue.
And I also think that what you do every day with those incredible kids is invaluable for really the future of our culture. And I want to thank you for what you do.
Thank you, Duo.
All right. Thank you, Turner. We're going to go to a little break. And after our break, we want you to call us at 203-336-9756. And we're going to leave you with one thought. I've been going to weddings because now I'm old enough to have children that have other children that they know, and the parents invite us to their weddings. And I've been amazed at the antiseptic and often programmatic translation of objects to love in weddings on wedding present lists. So I leave you with that, let you think about that. Maybe our guests will deal with that. So this is Homepage in WPKN Radio, 89.5 FM, a radio station that depends on your generosity to exist. And we'll go to a quick break. We'll come back, and you should make a donation to them.
Hold tight, wait till the party.
Welcome back to Homepage Radio and WPKN 89.5 FM on your dial and also at www.wpkn.org. All over the world for billions of human beings that could possibly listen to it. And joining me in the studio today are some incredible guests, but the wizard of this studio is Rod Richardson. Rod, how are you?
I am fine.
And he's been witness to, victimized by, the multiple witnesses of the obsession with objects. And I was going to ask Rod a simple question. Rod, are you afflicted with the object disease?
Probably, and more so than most. And the reason for this is that when I was a young person, when I was a kid, we would move every 4 to 5 years.
Wow.
And the way I dealt with it was by bringing my stuff from one location to another. So that provided the continuity, because we would move great distances. We would live in one town and then move into another state, and at one point move to another country. And so in order to have continuity with one's life, you take the objects with you, because that's your history.
Right.
And so, for example, I still have my teething ring.
Wow.
That I, as a little kid with new teeth coming in, was playing with, apparently, and I remember playing with it as a child, and it's still intact, and it still has liquid inside of it. It has these little plastic fishes that you would turn this ring. It's literally like a donut, right?
Probably highly toxic.
Probably, but it was sealed, and so the thing is, I would look at it, and the plastic fishes were all different colors, and I would hold it up to the light and like turn it around, and I remember doing that. And when I relocated it recently, I did the same sort of thing. Of course, it's much smaller now. But the other object that I have was a black light that I bought in the early 1970s. It was an incandescent light bulb that I bought on a Sunday after church, mm-hmm. and at some drugstore that was selling novelties and such. And this light bulb has traveled with me.
Does it still operate?
As a matter of fact, it does.
Wow.
Because I found it after I hadn't located it in about 10 or 12 years, and then I opened the box that it was in, and I pulled it out, and it was still in the original paper container I'd put it in. I put it in a lamp, turned it on, and it still worked.
And your white shirt glowed.
Yes, it did, and all the other white objects. And this is a light bulb that has traveled to France and back.
What?
So I didn't even blow it out when I had to use a converter to actually use it there.
So TSA still allows you to carry the bulb around?
This is a long time ago.
Oh, okay.
Before 9/11, when things were simpler, right? When you could carry anything you wanted. So those are just two examples.
Those are perfect human examples, and with me today in the studio are Joe DeRisi of Urban Miners, who takes bigger things and makes them smaller and creates objects from objects, and then gives them the space and gives them the provenance so people are interested in it. And also Carrie Triffin, who founded Fairhaven Woodworks that became Fairhaven Furniture, who I think really almost in a sense is like the mecca of those who love things, because the things in your store or your legacy, Carrie, are really lovable. What is the relationship you think between love and objects? We were just listening to some right here.
Oh boy! Every level. I mean, it can be. You suddenly discover that you have untold imagination. Well, then play with that. And what can I do that would be different? This would be exciting. There's
right.
Electricity. Take a walk on the wild side. Well, why can't I paint this room puce color?
Right, right.
And maybe it'll be cool. Maybe it'll be awful. But it'll be fun to try it.
I often think that objects, Joe, you probably have had this happen all the time. I think of objects as really being incredibly loved when they're missing. When you can't find this thing which exists now only in your memory, and you realize how much you love something because you can't find it.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine that in your demolition, you find things like that all the time.
All the time. Like I said before, the history that's in something... I think we have a push pull with objects because there's attachment. You can carry your history with you when you move. But we often, on a practical level, don't need to have a lot of those objects.
No.
So where do we balance it out? And this is whether we're talking about a house or a an old musical instrument that you don't play anymore.
Right.
But has decades, maybe intergenerational history to it.
Yeah.
Nobody plays it, so do we need to keep it?
Tell me just a brief history of urban miners and how you came to do what you do.
I have to condense it.
Very much so.
Object collection goes, I think we blame on my early childhood context. And then I began to appreciate old things when renovating houses in New Haven, pretty much. I understood that there was a big difference between a house from 1880 to production work and, you know, building a 100-unit condo. So I gravitated towards appreciating the value in the workmanship and such, and then realized the materials were unique. Mm. I'm a geographer and a planner, so I sort of started to look at the big picture, houses and context and neighborhoods and history and ownership, and then this demolition thing came along, and it said, maybe we need to make a transition with objects, but is throwing it away like we do paper cups the right way to do it?
Right.
And even though I was doing other work, I was advocating for this saving building thing and couldn't seem to get anyone locally to really put any energy into it.
And that was way before the whole green sustainability thing became fashionable.
Well, yeah, I mean, I started thinking about deconstruction in the 90s. When I worked for the Water Authority, I was advocating organic farming as an economic alternative,
right.
And
right.
they thought I was crazy in the early 80s with that. But obviously,
not.
That's been proven wrong. So deconstruction was going on in other parts of the country. And in our past, we, you know, my relatives in Maine who were Yankees, I'm sure, would not throw out a barn and then
right.
go buy new materials to build a new one.
They'd build it out of the
They'd
old materials.
Build out of the old ones. Everybody did that. It was
Swamp
it was,
Yankees.
It was, but I think we have such an abundance of resources, we think we could get away with throwing away things that we really don't want to. And I think that's why a lot of buildings, just to make it short, why a lot of buildings seem to get demolished on Sundays. And here's a curious thing. Demolition is a necessary industry, and I understand there's a place for it. But you'll notice if you ever see a building getting demolished, none of the equipment has the name of the company on it.
Right.
Just saying.
Now, a place that has a name on it is Fairhaven Furniture. Carrie, tell us how you came to make Fairhaven Woodworks, but then furniture and how you see it has evolved and how that evolution dovetails with your perception of value in objects.
Well, it started because my older daughter, Molly, who she was on all fours in the crib.
Perfect.
And trying to move forward with this incredible intentionality that she has to this day. And I wanted to be home the day that she got it,
of course.
That she figured out, oh, this is it. You put the hand forward and then the other one and the leg and the knee and the whatever. And I was home and it was wonderful. It was anticlimactic, but it was totally worth it. And so to be able to be home, I recouped some tools that I had owned years before and I'd lent to different organizations in New Haven and started making bookcases. And hawked them off the top of my grandmother's Ford Fairmont that she'd given me. I put a roof rack from a VW bus on top and had 15 or 20 bookcases on there. Hawked them outside of Yale Station on Elm Street, and they sold like hotcakes. So she was kind of the girl who launched 1,000 bookcases.
You're sort of like an IKEA.
Yeah, something like that.
So I would actually posit to the audience, yep, there's never been a Fairhaven Furniture. I think of you as being what IKEA should be. IKEA takes the industrial and the design and mass markets it, and I think of Fairhaven Furniture as a place which celebrates the idiosyncratic. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. And it's idiosyncrasies that go deep and affect and that we are true of all of us. I mean, most of us are working more than we'd like, running about more than we think graceful, accumulating more than we need or enjoy. But none of that diminishes our instinctive yearning for a simpler, deeper, more heartfelt place to be.
And you could get that,
and
you think,
home.
Through the objects, do you think?
I think you can. Because how an object makes you feel is more important, I think, or it's at least as important as how it looks. And there are objects that have a personality. They're either attached to a personality that comes from the person who made it, rubby-dubbying it,
right,
or from the person who you got it from, who might be a relative and you might have wonderful memories of, or an object that just spoke to you and you said, wow, I love that. That makes me feel good to see that and to be in its presence. So I want that.
And when people bring you the objects that they literally have made, you must have to then evaluate that object in light of the designer and fabricator. And then you have to have that object and then evaluate it in terms of the person that's coming to get it from you. How is that interaction
changed? Oh, I love it. I mean, I think of myself as being a person who tries to reduce, oh gosh, what's the word now? I'm blocking on it. But I think there's opportunities there for a wonderful relationship between the consumer, the buyer, the client, the maker, the wood itself,
right,
or the material itself, and how we do that relationship in a way that enhances the moment,
yep,
and that everybody feels good. And that you walk away feeling like, I mean, I don't feel like when a customer walks into the store, I actually particularly love it if it's somebody who's never been there before,
yep,
and maybe somebody who shies away. Oh, don't know, the salesperson. It's for me, it's like being in the White Mountains hiking on a trail, and I see somebody approaching from the distance. We're, yep, probably not going to go through the rest of our lives together, but we will be in one place at one time for at least a moment. How much value can we exchange?
Right.
Maybe we break bread, yep, together.
But you often have food there.
Yeah, sometimes.
Okay. So, Joe, I think this is really fascinating because here you've got on one side of the spectrum the connection of people to objects that Carrie is talking about. But you actually disassemble things that have been collected by people, and then you reintroduce them to people. Tell me a little bit about that dynamic. How is the connection to people facilitated by what you do, and do you actually make that connection? Right now, you've got one of the great things going on, which is you are disassembling some of the tobacco barns up around the airport in near Springfield, and you are creating these plank objects out of it, and you have to be finding people that want that. A is a really cool material from anywhere, but there have to be people that say, I want a piece of those really cool places. Is that true?
That's totally true. And in particular, because those barns are so visible.
Yes.
I've had a lot of people calling me up and saying there's the people who want have a barn and need wood that matches.
Right.
But I think there's a real incentive in this particular case because they see the source and it's really obvious and they want to be a part of that. I actually had a customer who she just bought some. There were some pots inside the barn, and she said, "I want those partly because they're in that barn because I've been looking at that barn
really?
for years and years and years.
Amazing.
Even though they weren't directly related to the tobacco industry, they had more to do with landscaping on the premises. But they were in the barn." They were sort of part of the mix, and that's what she could buy. She didn't need a barn,
wow,
but she could use those. I think, there's the character of the wood itself because of how it's been exposed.
Right.
It's had tobacco drying on it. It's a certain color from, the exposure.
The outgassing.
So then there's the creative part. There's introducing people to what it is and what it's been. And then sort of launching people, and some need more launching than others, right? Artists
right.
And craftsmen come in, and they see the object, and they already know what it's going to be.
Right.
And then I have the customers where it's like, there's so many things you could do with this, and here's some ideas. I was kind of enjoying that whole conversation, that Carrie's point about that time with the customer. It's... when I was younger, I used to really abhor the idea of being a salesman because my experience was they're trying to sell you something you don't need.
Right.
In this case, we're trying to demonstrate how there's a more need for these items than what you think you need.
Right? And I think, Carrie, that's right in your wheelhouse, yeah. Because whenever I've gone to Fairhaven Furniture, it's almost never with, I've got to get X. It's more like, let's see what's there. And then mm-hmm. when you find this thing, the thing's almost talking to you, not the other way around.
Yeah.
And you're almost like the translator. Is that true?
Translator, interesting. Yeah.
That's speaking one language. The other people are speaking human, and yeah. you sort of are sort of mind meld between the
like
mind meld between the object and the person.
Yeah, and it is at a very basic level. It's at a human
elemental.
Level. It's just it's elemental. It's not. There's no. At that point, you know, you're not being a salesman. You're just a translator. I like that.
So there's a new translator in town, and it's a huge translator, and it's one that I find to be miraculous and fabulous, but also deeply, deeply disturbing, which is, of course, new media, which is Etsy, which is the list for all the weddings and the wedding websites where you can buy 3 hours in an English pub in their honeymoon, or you could do all this other kind of activity, which is mediated, mitigated, packaged, formed, and made a profit by the internet. How have you two guys, either one or both speak up, how have you two guys seen how the internet has affected what you've been doing now for the last 30 years?
Huh. Well, my master's thesis was basically said, we can take all these materials on a large scale, and now we could really capture them because we have the internet to be able to connect all the locations with items that might be very specific, so you need a large audience. In other words, my next door neighbor is unlikely to need a 12 by 12 inch barn beam,
right?
But somebody within the region does. So I had an internet based a business plan as far as that. So, but one of the things I learned is that the internet is a good vehicle. But when it comes to old things, because of the character and everything that's, or crafted things, because of what's captured in it, you can't convey it online completely. That's they have to come in and see it and
touch
and then
it.
And the important thing is that human conversation, because it's hard to have that through an internet listing. You can't talk about the artist and his history and how his family cut the tree down to make the wood or whatever it is. You really have to have that element, I think.
Carrie, how's your work been changed by the internet?
Well, I think, for one thing, stuff happens a lot faster. Somebody somewhere starts working with live edge boards, and
right.
suddenly, wow, everybody knows about live edge boards. Isn't that great? There's way more people with that interest.
Yep.
And yet, at our scale, you know, unlike room and board or whatever, and this, well, at our scale, it can really go beyond just, a board with a live edge.
Right.
And most of our advertising, to me, should be the finger beckoning.
Right.
Ooh, come.
Invitation.
See this.
Invitation,
gotta,
right.
You got to check this out. And then you can introduce people to, it's not just that it's a live edge board. Look at the grain within this particular board and what
happened
here.
And touch the grain. Feel the grain.
And touch it. And you know what? Right there, you see that little glint of metal? That's a bullet that was shot at this tree who knows how long ago.
Okay.
And it's just opens the pathways.
It's interesting how the modern culture has had this gateway drug of the internet to essentially give people a broader sense of almost touchless addiction to things in terms of a two-dimensional visual reality. But there is another reality which isn't in any realm except our brains, which is this sense, this ethic, this old ethic that Joe was talking about, the swamp Yankee ethic of what's now called sustainability or green. But the truth is, has always been there in terms of, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. If you've got it, don't throw it away. Don't waste anything. I was going to ask both of you guys, again, you can basically jump in and either way think about it. You've both done what you're doing before it became a kind of cachet to be sustainable and green, but now both of you are in this wonderful new world of where there's added value if there is a recycled or low energy profile in creation of objects that are still loved, but they've got a backstory to them of being Swamp Yankee objects. What do you guys see as being a part of that in your work? sustainability, green, that kind of a thing. Joe, you're right in the middle of it because you actually are repurposing everything.
Yeah, and we're talking about diverting millions of tons of materials. So back to the gourd joke, I'm saving a barn board that has unique character, but there's 12,000 square feet of that unique character we have to try to convey to someone else, right? To make it work. I think that obviously the environmental impact is the reduction of waste, but the bigger impact is that you've now created a resource that has value and secondary value, which is I can recover a board, and then one of the craftspeople that makes furniture that is sold at Fairhaven Furniture is now creating another industry, and now we're creating the retail, and now people have stuff that's much better than they would have had. So that whole chain has to be looked at.
Right. How about you, Carrie? What? How has this sustainability last 20 years of enhanced value impacted you guys?
I'm not sure how to answer that except to say that as a merchant, I should be here saying bye, bye, bye. But as a human being, I'm here saying less is more. Less can really be more. And have it be that. Have less and have it stuff that has more stuff to it, that has more love attached to it, that has more excitement and joy attached to it.
I find it, you know, I don't know if you guys watch the television program. It's only one of the three things I watch called Pickers. And Pickers is about two people that roam around. Obviously, it's a TV show, so this isn't real. But they roam around and find hoarders and essentially siphon off provenance out of what a hoarder collects in a room that nobody ever sees. And I think what you both do is the literal inversion of hoarding. It's almost, as you say, creating the precious quality of the objects that are either sort of glued together, in your case, Joe, or actually unseen unless they're in a place like yours, Carrie. So in these last couple seconds or few minutes, tell us what you think is the kind of seminal reality of objects today in our culture. Carrie, do you have any thoughts on that?
Like a broken record, just we have too much stuff.
Yeah.
And focus on not having stuff. Henry David Thoreau thought that one of the things that he was most pleased with about himself is that he had come to want so little.
Yes.
And wanting little allows you to look at what you have and what's available.
Well, I mean, is it a cause or effect that if we have too many things, that it devalues things, right? Because we don't have a chair made three generations ago. So the chair we do have is disposable. And does that translate into how we treat other things?
And other people.
Right. Yes. And I think that's one of the things for me. If we're able to throw away entire houses and not wink, why are we ever going to stop throwing away cups?
Look, I can't thank you guys enough for your time. This has been a terrific discussion. I'm going to leave people with a Dalai Lama quote, which I do think speaks exactly to what you guys have just said. The Dalai Lama said, "People are created to be loved. Things are created to be used. The world is in chaos now because things are being loved and people are being used." This is Duo Dickinson at Homepage WPKN. Be looking for a podcast of this show, and please, please donate to one of the great places in America, WPKN Radio in Bridgeport, New York. Connecticut.
Connecticut. Serving Suffolk County in New York.
But serving New York.
All right. Support for WPKN comes from Grillo Services of Milford, Connecticut, supplying organic topsoil, organic compost, mulch, dumpsters, decorative gravel, and more
to Connecticut's residential, commercial, and municipal customers. Detailed information on all their organic garden and landscape services at grilloservices.com or 203-877-5070.
Support for WPKN comes from RVNA, a nonprofit Medicare-certified health agency providing health care at home in 28 communities in Western Connecticut, including nursing, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and live-in caregivers. More information at richfieldvna.org or 203-438-5555.
50 years ago on a beautiful June weekend in 1967, at the height of the Summer of Love, the Monterey International Pop Festival roared forward, capturing a decade's spirit and ushering in a new era of rock and roll. Monterey would launch the careers of Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and Otis Redding, but they were just a few among a wildly diverse cast that included Simon and Garfunkel, the Mamas and the Papas, The Who, The Birds, Hugh Masekela, and the extraordinary Ravi Shankar. With his characteristic verite style, director D.A. Pennybaker captured it all. Join us on Thursday, June 22nd at the Bijou Theater for a rare opportunity to see this remastered film on the big screen with remastered audio as well. All tickets will be at the door, and the doors open at 6 p.m. with a beer tasting courtesy of Two Roads and Monterey Pop Music Outtakes in the lobby. The film screens at 7 p.m. Tickets are $15 for adults and $10 for students. See you on Thursday, June 22nd for Monterey Pop at the Bijou in downtown Bridgeport. And WPKN thanks sponsors Two Roads Brewing, Bridgeport DSSD, and Cohen & Wolf Law Firm.
Bridge House in Bridgeport, Connecticut is a psychosocial rehabilitation program for adults recovering from the persistent effects of psychiatric illness. As a certified clubhouse of Clubhouse International, it is operated by members for members. Bridge House is a safe, caring,